It's increasingly difficult to have a nuanced conversation about anything. It just gets immediately pulled to the extreme binaries. And I find that deeply frustrating, if I'm honest.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile. I am Emma Fowle. The Profile is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Head over to premierchristianity.com/podcast for your exclusive half-price subscription offer. Today on the podcast, I am joined by Right Reverend Gully Francis Dekani, the Bishop of Chelmsford. Born in Iran, Bishop Gully came to the UK as a teenager following the attempted assassination of her father, the Bishop of Iran, and the horrific murder of her brother, aged just 24. The experiences of her childhood years and the example of her parents' unwavering faith in the face of such adversity have unsurprisingly grown an unafraid faith in the cleric, leading her to become an outspoken advocate on a whole range of social justice issues. In this episode of the podcast, she shares her life story with us, speaks about her experiences of being a female priest in a changing Church of England, and tells me why she won't quit speaking up on matters she cares about, no matter what criticism comes her way. So thank you so much, Bishop Gully, for being with us this morning on The Profile. It's a real pleasure to meet you. I wonder if you might start by telling us a little bit about your early years. They're probably not going to be like most people's listening to this podcast. I know you have a very incredible story of growing up. Would you just tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you came to the UK?
Thank you very much for your welcome. It's really good to be here. Yes, I had what most people would consider an unusual upbringing, I guess, between and betwixt two worlds, really. I was born in Iran into the very, very small Anglican community there. My father was a convert from Islam, and by the time I was born, he'd been ordained and was bishop of this small community. Geographically, Iran is a very large diocese, but numerically, it's always been quite small. And when I was growing up in the kind of late 60s and 70s, the church was very much trying to kind of come to terms with its identity as a fully Persian church. It had its roots in the missionary movement. And my mother was, in fact, the daughter and indeed the granddaughter of missionaries, British missionaries in Iran. But she herself had been born in Iran and was raised there and lived her life there. And as I say, the church had its roots in the missionary movement, but was, seeking a fully Persian identity, which was particularly apparent in styles of worship and language, obviously, of worship and architecture of church buildings and so on and so forth, as well as a developing indigenous leadership, taking over, as it were, from what had been missionary leadership in the earlier years. And so I grew up as part of a Christian home and obviously the church environment that we were in. But then outside our doors was an entirely Muslim environment. The country is 99.9% Shia Muslim. I was at school at an ordinary school, so I was the only Christian in an otherwise entirely Islamic environment. I grew up with both languages because the presence of the missionaries brought with it English. So I grew up speaking both languages and I guess also with a kind of mixture of Eastern and Western cultural influences, again, from our home life in Iran, but inevitably the missionaries and many, many foreign travellers and people would come through and they'd bring with them the kind of Western influences. So always a mixture. And so I grew up in a sense, my whole identity is predicated on a complexity and it's not easy to define clearly. What I am or what my roots are. But it was a very happy childhood for the most part, lots of security and, these two distinct worlds overlapped from time to time but coexisted for the most part peaceably alongside one another, school and church and wider society and home life. And until the revolution hit, as it were, in the kind of late 1970s, first becoming apparent in 1978 and then gaining full momentum in 1979. And it turned our lives upside down, both of the church community and, you know, my family more particularly. The church became a target because we were made up essentially of converts from Islam or second, third generation Christians like me. And in the current version of Islam in Iran, apostasy is considered a sin as well as a crime. And so that the church has been heavily persecuted and, you know, for the past 40 years or so. But there was an intensity in those early years in which our institutions were all either confiscated or closed down. Many left in the early stages. The financial assets of the church were frozen. Our legal status was stripped away. People were imprisoned. There were assassination attempts, including on my father's life. After having been in prison for a brief period, there was an attack on his life, which he survived, but my mother was injured in that attack. And then several months later, in May 1980, for us as a family, events culminated in the assassination of my brother, who was 24 at the time. My father was out of the country at the time, and really he was the main target. My brother became a scapegoat, I guess. And so we then left, my mother and my eldest sister and I left. My other sister was already in England, training to be a nurse. We left to join my father here, advised not to return for the time being. Everybody thought this was going to blow over. So we came to join him here, expecting to be back home within a matter of months or a year at the most. And obviously the way events turned out, that was never to happen. So he lived out the rest of his ministry as bishop in Iran in exile until his retirement. And he died several years ago now. And we, you know, arrived essentially as refugees and were given eventually our permission to stay. And over the years, I've kind of made a life for myself here.
Wow, that's such an incredible story. And I have so many questions. And it would be very easy to go through something like that. And actually, it caused your whole faith to fall apart. How did your family's faith survive the assassination of your brother and all of the hardship that you had to go through?
My parents were really extraordinary people. I mean, they've both died now, but they had a very, very deep, authentic faith, which they knew early on in the revolution. They knew that it was going to be tested. And I still recall a sermon that my father preached. I must have been about 11 or 12 at the time, in the early stages of the revolution, in which he said words to the effect of, you know, we preach forgiveness, we preach reconciliation, we preach being people of goodwill and so on. And that is going to be tested in the coming period. And, you know, our faith is nothing if we don't live it out when we enter times of trial and temptation. And they, you know, it was very genuine to them. I don't think it was something that was a kind of difficult choice. That doesn't mean it wasn't painful. And certainly for my father, he spent most of his life really coming to terms with the fact that by his own country folk, he was regarded as someone who'd betrayed his faith and his nationality and everything that goes with that in Eastern culture. And then on top of that, coming to terms with the fact that if he'd been in Iran, his son wouldn't have been murdered. So it was a very painful journey for them, but it was one that they travelled very much together. I kind of observed, I suppose, and absorbed a lot of that, and then had to make choices in my adult life about whether I was going to try and follow a similar pathway or not. It's not straightforward. There are lots of questions. There are lots of doubts. There's, you know, all kinds of things that are impossible to completely iron out. You know, we have to live with a certain amount of uncertainty, I think, and complexity and questions and so on. But I haven't found a better way. And in the end, faith undergirds all of that, rather than being something that I feel I need to make a choice to move away from.
And was it ever a struggle for you? Was there a point in your life where you're like, I don't know if I can forgive these people in the same way or as easy as I've seen my parents do it?
It wasn't easy. I don't think it was easy for my parents. I don't think forgiveness is ever easy, and it's a kind of process and lots of twists and turns. I think it's about the desire or the will to want to forgive, and also, you know, at its most painful. My father wrote a prayer for my brother's funeral. Obviously, he wasn't there himself, but it's become known as the forgiveness prayer. But I'm struck in it that, you know, he doesn't at any point say, I forgive. He asks God to forgive, you know, Father, forgive, which is also what Jesus did on the cross. It's also what St. Stephen did as he was being stoned. So sometimes I think when we struggle with the notion of forgiveness ourselves, it's perhaps enough just to kind of want to move in that direction, to kind of lean into it, to live with a posture of forgiveness. But absolutely never easy, and never something that should be imposed on anybody when they're going through times of particular challenge or difficulty. So I've learnt so much over the years. Have I ever kind of struggled to stay in faith? Yes, probably in my kind of 20s. I think I maybe became a bit disillusioned. I tried to leave it all behind and move on, but I wasn't, to be honest with you, ever particularly good at it. And I never walked away entirely. And as I say, I still feel I move between a kind of tidal waves that take me to the shores of certainty and then pull me back to periods of doubt and questioning and darkness and so on. But I just think that's part of faith, you know. It would be strange if we didn't. We're not automatons, you know. It's right that we have questions and struggles and so on. But as I say, ultimately, the knowledge of God's love with us through all the trials of life, and we all face them at various times, that is the most reassuring thing. And so why on earth would I walk away from it?
I think that's such a common experience, isn't it? I can certainly remember that for myself, being at university in particular and getting slightly distracted by the things of the world. And I can remember one day having a conversation with myself walking down the road and being like, it would be so much easier if I could just pretend that God didn't exist. And like having this sort of almost debate in my head, but there were things that I had experienced of God that I knew I couldn't deny. And so for me, in the end, that was, I think, what kept me in faith. I was like, I know that God is real because I've had these experiences and I can't explain them in any other way. What was the thing for you that kept you from walking away from it?
Faith is a kind of, you know, it's a cliche, isn't it, to say it's a journey, but it really is. And, you know, there are ups and downs. And overall, I think I've seen more of goodness and love and light and so on in people and in the experiences I've had, even at their, you know, and that's the mystery, isn't it, of faith, that even in the most terrible situations, it is possible to have glimpses of light and goodness through the kindness that people have, through the inner experiences that we have of God's presence with us. And, you know, I overall feel hugely blessed in my life. And I've tried to, at every juncture, to kind of, you know, accept that difficulties and challenges and pain are part of life. They come to all of us in some shape or form. Now, some people have a great deal more of it than their fair share. And, you know, that's the other side of the coin as Christians, the kind of striving towards justice and calling out where there's wrongdoing and where there's evil and so on. That's also part of it. I'm absolutely not talking about just kind of sitting back on our laurels and just saying, well, you know, whatever God wills. We are part of, we are co-creators with God of bringing about the kingdom of God. And so striving towards calling out for justice, working for justice, you know, crying out to the Lord in distress, lament, you know, all of those things are also part of faith. But ultimately, if we're willing to see it, then God is present in all of it. That's been my experience, and it's a kind of love that never lets you go, and is perhaps even most potent at the darkest times. And again, that's the paradox, that's the mystery of the Christian faith.
Yeah, and I think you can really see that, can't you, when we look at the persecuted church, how it's growing under pressure, when you hear these incredible stories coming out of places where, you know, being a Christian, just being a Christian, puts you in the most, you know, vital risk. And yet the church is exploding. People are willing to live their lives in a way that perhaps in the West, when we're a little bit more comfortable and a little bit easy, more easy, doesn't happen. And I can definitely see it, you know, seeing the things that you campaign for, the things you're outspoken on, refugees, asylum seekers, housing, social justice, speaking about Israel and Gaza. Is that the fruit of what you've been through in your own life? Is that what it's given you, this passion for speaking out for social justice?
I mean, possibly. You know, our early experiences are very significant, aren't they? And they shape us. And you know, I do have a sense that not just kind of my own personal vocation being about, you know, one of calling out or working for justice and so on, but actually a fundamental belief that that's what the church should be involved in. The church should be on the side of those who are most marginalised, the poorest, and seeking to bring justice where there is no justice. So, it, you know, it's difficult to say whether it's directly related to my early experiences. Certainly it has been shaped by my early experiences. And, you know, I absolutely agree with you. There are extraordinary stories across the world of places of persecution where the church is growing. There are also places like Iran where persecution is slowly suffocating the church. And, you know, numbers aren't actually growing because they're not permitted. They're not allowed to baptise. They're not allowed to bring new people in and so on. So for me, there's also something about the persecuted church offering a gift to the Western church to be not anxious about whether we're small or large, because the fruits of our efforts are in the end for God to work with, as it were. I think the call on our lives is to be faithful as best we can in the present moment, which means faithful in prayer and in worship and in gathering as a community, and also faithful in service, in loving our neighbour and looking outwards to the world. And if that bears fruit with numbers, that's fantastic. We rejoice in that, and we want people to come to Christ. But sometimes it doesn't, and that doesn't diminish those efforts. And it doesn't mean that small churches, and where numbers are small, are any less valued by God. You know, that the small and the marginal are precious in the sight of God. And for me, that's part of the gift of the persecuted to the Church of England, and, you know, to Christians in the West. They say we don't need to be anxious. The church has waxed and waned in size over the centuries. It's typically not necessarily been at its best when it's been largest and most influential. And we don't need to be anxious. We continue planting the seeds, and God, in God's own time, will bring forth the harvest, as it were. So it's not about not being intentional. We have to be intentional in our discipleship and in how we seek to serve the communities that we're part of. But it does mean not being anxious, and it does mean not being worried. And I'm really struck that in Iran, you know, over the last 40 years or so, there's been very, very little by way of leadership. Numbers are so small as to be almost insignificant. There have been no kind of programs or plans or strategies. And yet it seems that the Holy Spirit has had space to breathe. And, you know, maybe not in the Anglican Church because of the strictures around it, but many Iranians are coming to faith. Either through the underground church movements in Iran or in this country and other countries around the world. So when given space, that the Holy Spirit will blow and will do what the Holy Spirit does. And our task, I suppose, is to play our part as best we can without being unduly anxious about the future.
Now, you're a female bishop. You wrote a PhD on religious feminism in an age of empire. There's a lot of intersection going on here. And you spoke earlier about growing up in an Anglican church that was being reclaimed or, you know, repopulated by Iranian leadership rather than the British missionaries that come in and sowing the seeds of faith, perhaps in a Muslim country. You've spoken, touched a little bit on some of those complexities. How does that feed into how you operate now as a bishop in the Anglican Church, in the UK, but in a very multicultural area? Essex is pretty mixed, it's pretty diverse. What does that bring to the table for you? What are the things, how do you think the church can do this better, whether it's overseas mission or whether it's encouraging greater diversity in the way we do church here in the UK?
You know, the idea of overseas missionaries in the way that they operated back in the 18th, 19th, even early 20th century is not very popular now, often condemned. For me, again, there's more complexity around it. I don't know, we're drawn increasingly nowadays to polarised views. We either have to think something's wonderful or we have to think it's awful. And I know when I started my PhD research, I was really kind of, I was anxious because I felt that I was going to have to ask this question. Were the missionaries right to go and evangelise people who'd never heard of Jesus or the gospel, or were they wrong? I kind of felt a bit obsessed by that question. And I was looking particularly at female missionaries, Church Missionary Society in Iran. And actually, over the course of the research that I did, of course, I discovered that that's an irrelevant question, in a sense, that we can't answer it now from our cultural context about people from 100, 200 years ago. And I decided it was much more interesting to engage as much as I could in a conversation with them, to look at the sources as much as they were available, to try and understand them from the context in which they operated. And yes, of course, shed some light from our priorities now, but I didn't feel the need to judge them about whether they were right or wrong. They did some, unwise things. They did some shocking things. You know, they did things that, of course, we wouldn't do now. But they were also men and women of deep faith and lived extraordinarily sacrificial lives in order to share the gospel. Now, we can argue the rights and wrongs of it, and it's not straightforward. But for me, it demonstrates that the complexity of relationships and the need to be sensitive when we engage with people of other faith or with people whose experience of Christianity is different to ours. I think we're kind of moving in the direction as a Christian community, if I can put it that way, of understanding much more that that diversity plays into both our own understanding of faith, but also how we engage with one another. And that's been quite a struggle for the Church of England, I think. There is a real desire to do that better, and we have a huge amount to learn from one another. But for me, that's not about just throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying all of the past, was wrong and we must kind of somehow obliterate it or take a completely different approach. There's always things to learn, both from the mistakes that were made and from the good things that were done. I hope we're better at understanding cross-cultural mission now, which ultimately mean greater sensitivity, a willingness to learn from one another, and also to understand that we love to put people in boxes. You know, you are either global majority heritage or you're white British or whatever. I don't particularly fit easily into any box, and that's okay. That's okay. And I don't have to be put there, and I can learn from everything that shaped me, and I don't feel the need for that to restrict me either. I'm shaped by my past, but I'm not hostage to it. And that's the whole point. In Christ, we're led to always become a new creation.
Hmm. You've been quite outspoken over the last couple of years about the whole refugee asylum situation. And obviously being on the south-ish coast of the UK, you're probably quite close to the actual what's going on with small boats coming across the channel and all of that. What role do you think the church plays in doing this well?
Yeah, that's a really important and increasingly, I think, again, complicated question for us. Look, on one hand, I'm absolutely clear that the role of the church is to offer welcome, hospitality and space to those who are marginal, those who are outsiders, whatever shape that takes on, you know, in the wider community that each church is based. And that includes asylum seekers and refugees. It includes a whole host of other people as well, but it also includes asylum seekers and refugees. So absolutely no doubt in my mind, we should be, and indeed there are many, many good examples of this, churches opening their doors, offering welcome, offering practical support as well as emotional and so on and so forth. And importantly, I think not just giving, not just offering hospitality and warmth and welcome, but actually enabling people to find space in which they can contribute and they can give something to the new society that they're a part of. You know, churches, I think, often find it easier to offer hospitality than they do to be kind of guests at the table of others. And actually, refugees and asylum seekers have a great deal to offer us as well as needing our support and help. So it's a two-way thing. So that's all given. However, I do have this sense that we could develop in how we listen better and engage with those who are feeling so marginalised in their communities. And I'm talking now about, you know, white British people, particularly in deprived, you know, economically deprived areas. There is something going on in terms of the kind of antagonism towards refugees and asylum seekers that comes from the experience of some of those people. Now, some of it is just unacceptable thuggery and so on. But I just have this sense that we do need to listen and engage with those experiences to understand what it is. You know, there are people who are feeling disenfranchised, marginalised and so on. And it's very easy to look for people and places to blame, and therefore refugees become an easy target. And whilst countering that narrative, we perhaps do need to be doing a little bit more by way of listening and engaging with those who are feeling marginalised and so on. I don't quite know how we do that. I think it's complicated for churches to work out how to do that well. But I just have this sense that it's something we ought to be attending to and thinking about a little bit more deeply.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate? Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
Yeah, and for you, I mean, over in Chelmsford, Essex, that's an area that is very geographically affected by this. It has a high propensity of people that voted Brexit, for example, some fairly low-income areas. How does that play out for your diocese? Like, can you see it playing out practically or not?
Yeah, I mean, Chelmsford Diocese is a microcosm of the Church of England and indeed, therefore, the whole nation. It does cover Essex, but it also covers five boroughs in East London. So there is enormous diversity. And, you know, what is it that connects Saffron Walden at one end through to Barking and Dagenham and Stratford at the other, and then the whole coastal regions around Southend and Thurrock, and, you know. So we have pretty much everything, and that makes for great diversity and richness, It also makes for challenge, of course, in terms of how we identify across the diocese with one another in our churches, never mind in the wider communities. So again, in terms of Chelmsford Diocese, we have to be quite intentional if we want to have a diocesan identity that both offers, if we're talking specifically about this issue, that both offers welcome and hospitality and so on, whilst also listening and engaging with the kind of more rooted, it's difficult to find the right words, but those who have been in some of our communities for longer. You know, in places like Newham, in the Barking area of the diocese, I'm told it's one of the most diverse places on the planet, you know, in terms of the numbers of nationalities and languages and faiths rubbing alongside each other. But, you know, for the most part, it's fantastic. For the most part, there are stories of good relationships, positive working of people of different faiths and outlooks and so on. And, you know, we should celebrate that. Where there are challenges, then we work together and we try to engage with partners of, you know, other faith communities and no faith communities, civic groups and so on. There's a lot of goodwill and there's lots of examples of good practice. So we rejoice in those and we continue trying to support our parishes where there might be challenges or difficulties.
Now, you, before you became a priest, you studied music. Your first degree. So can you tell me, was the Church of England always the plan? Did you always want to be a priest? How did that come about?
No, it certainly wasn't always the plan. I mean, growing up, women weren't even allowed to be ordained. So in that sense, it didn't, in the Church of England anyway, or the Anglican Church. So no, it would not have occurred to me. You know, truth be told, I would love to have been a musician, but I never really had the talent that was needed, and I certainly didn't have the opportunities to build on whatever ability I did have. I used to play the flute, but at university I did everything I could. I loved my time at university. I played the flute, I conducted, I sang, you know, I got involved in as much music making as I could, but I was never going to make it as a professional musician. And when I left the BBC, I initially got a job in the... Sorry, when I left university, I initially got a job in the BBC working at World Service Radio, which was, again, the most extraordinary experience. I was a studio manager, a little bit like a sound engineer, and had a wonderful couple of years there. But it involved shift work, so I very quickly got out of the way of playing in any regular orchestra or anything like that. So, that life feels like a different time really now, a different life altogether. I live my joy of music largely through my children now, who play and keep me involved in that way. And then when I left the BBC... really, I'd got married by that stage, and we left London in order for my husband to start training to be ordained. So I left the BBC taking a bit of a leap of faith, really, not knowing what would be next, and eventually went on to do a master's, an MA in religious studies, theology and religious studies at Bristol University, and then kind of went on to do the PhD from there. And I suppose I was at a crossroads in my life, particularly as I was doing the masters, wondering what I was going to do with the rest of my life and what, you know, what God's call on my life was. It didn't seem obvious to me. It was other people who suggested that I explore ordination. And so I did it really as a kind of leap of faith. I thought, okay, well, let's explore this. Sadly, didn't have a Damascus Road experience or any strong sense of calling. It's been much, much more gradual over many years as it's unfolded. And I've tried at each step of the way to kind of faithfully do whatever I've been able to do in the context that I found myself. And the kind of story, the journey has unfolded as I've gone. I've always had a sense that my background and my experiences in Iran have a part to play in my life story and my ministry. And now that really involves keeping alive the name of the church in Iran and praying for and supporting the tiny community there, who are really very beleaguered. But they're a precious part of the Anglican Communion, and it's definitely part of my calling to keep their name alive.
Wow. And how has your journey through the Church of England been as a woman? As you said, when you were growing up, there weren't even any women ministers within the Church of England. Now you're a female bishop. I think it's easy to forget, actually, that it's become so much broader in the last few years, that probably for a young person who knows little about the history looking in now, oh, it's brilliant, there's loads of women in ministry. It's still a very, very recent phenomenon, and still something that parts of the church are reckoning with. What has your experience been?
Yes, we have come a very, very long way. I can't really say, in a sense, what I have got nothing to compare it with. You know, I'm a woman, and this is the path I've been on, and so I've experienced it for who I am. We've just celebrated 30 years of female priests in the Church of England. And in that period, we've come a long way. I'm often mindful of the many, many women, generations of women who came beforehand, who maybe had a sense of calling and never had the opportunity for that to be fulfilled. But it's on their shoulders that everything that's happened in the last 30 years or so has been possible. And some of those are the missionary women that I research. You know, they were extraordinary people of faith and resilience and commitment, who worked within quite tight boundaries, but were very, very good at just gently pushing those boundaries, not too hard, not too fast to kind of frighten the horses, but enough to just create new opportunities for the women that followed on. We still have struggles, that there are, I think there are many female priests in the Church of England, certainly, who still experience quite a lot of discrimination and who have had journeys that have been very painful indeed. I consider myself enormously blessed. Of course, it's been painful at times, and it still is. But I've, at critical junctures in my life, I've had people who've believed in me, who've supported me, who've encouraged me, who've given me opportunities where they didn't need to. And some of those have been women themselves. So for myself, I feel hugely blessed, but I'm conscious that it's not something that we can yet take for granted. The Church of England still kind of makes provision for parishes and individuals to exempt themselves from the ministry of women. And that's the reality of where we are, and we work as well as we can within that, and accept that, you know, it sort of takes us to the foot of the cross, this kind of stuff. You know, it's painful, but we always try to build relationships across divisions. That's what we're called to do. And as I say, I personally have been very, very blessed and very fortunate.
And now, obviously, you're a bishop. You also sit in the House of Lords. You're one of the Lords Spiritual. And I mean, there's actually been some debate in the last few weeks, really, hasn't there, about whether or not that's a thing that should continue to exist. Do you feel strongly that as bishops you have a place within UK politics?
I don't know. I'm a bit conflicted on it, if I'm honest. I think it's a very legitimate debate to have, and we should hear from all sides, and there will be people who will feel passionately one way or another. I think the way I approach it is to say that whilst we're there, let's try and use our positions for good, and let's try and involve ourselves in ways that are beneficial both to the House of Lords itself, but also to the wider nation. Would I fight tooth and nail to keep our place there? Not sure. It's difficult, isn't it? The relationship with the establishment and power structures is a really uncomfortable one. And I'm not sure it's always helpful for the Church of England, but it is part of the history and it is where we are. And so we should navigate those as well as we can with as much care and respect and so on as we can. And I do think that my colleagues and I in the House of Lords try never to take for granted our place there. And we try to be as respectful as we can in terms of how we play our part. Do we have a relevant voice? Absolutely, I think we do while we're there. We represent between us many, many, many communities right across the country. And so we speak out of experiences in those communities and a desire to play our part well. So it's for others in the end to decide whether we remain there or not. But whilst we're there, I hope we can play our part as well as possible.
But you obviously feel quite strongly as a Christian individually that you should be speaking out on the issues of social justice, because I mean I see you do it quite often, whether it's on social media or in the press. So that's obviously a personal conviction for you. Actually, I'm a Christian, but I believe I need to speak into these issues.
Yeah, very much so. And I think we can all do that in our own way. The position I happen to hold gives me a particular platform. And so I try to use that as well as I can. It's increasingly difficult. It's increasingly difficult to have a nuanced conversation about anything. It just gets immediately pulled to the extreme binaries. And I find that deeply frustrating, if I'm honest. Social media, you know, inevitably, whether I do an interview like this one or you know, with a broadsheet or whatever, in the end, it ends up on social media, heavily redacted, reduced, often to a headline, which will then take you to the article, which is behind a paywall. So people's impressions go by just one line or one aspect of what you said. And most of these issues don't fit neatly like that. So it is frustrating, but I think, you know, we each play our part according to the possibilities that we have, the opportunities that we have. And it would feel wrong for me not to do that in my role. Of course, it's costly at times. I get heavily, heavily criticised, and it's very unpleasant. And some of the attacks are deeply personal. But you know, we were never promised an easy ride.
And I wonder if part of that is also because of, you know, your family and your upbringing. You've watched your family make such sacrifices, and you've watched other people that you know and love make such sacrifices for the things they believe in. Do you think there's a part of you maybe that's just like, I need to stand up and be counted with this, even if it costs me?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I do. And there have been many occasions when, you know, when things have been particularly difficult, where I remember my parents and my father, whose life was on the line, and I suddenly get a sense of perspective that actually, really, you know, it's not. I don't have it too bad, and we don't have it too bad in this country. You know, we're free to speak out and so on. So yeah, it gives me a sense of perspective, it is a, you know, every day I think about my parents and what they went through. And it provides enough inspiration to get through whatever it is. And there's much that's good and much that's wonderful. And as I say, I feel hugely privileged, really, and blessed.
Mm. And you're currently the bishop responsible for housing, aren't you? So would you explain to us, but perhaps, you know, for a lot of our listeners that are not Anglican, that don't understand how the Church of England works, some people listening to this might be going, a bishop for housing? How does that work? Like, what's that got to do with the church? What does it have to do with the church? What is your job in that role?
Yeah, it's a very fair question. So a few years ago, there was an Archbishop's Commission on housing and housing, church and community. And the commission reported back, they published their report back in, I think it was February 2021. The report is called Coming Home. And that report had within it a series of recommendations both to government and also to kind of those in the housing sector, developers and landowners and so on. But I also had some recommendations to the church. The Church of England, many people won't know this, is the second largest landowner in England. So we own collectively a huge amount of land. The problem is that that land is held in different ways and by different groups. A lot of it is owned, the biggest bulk of it is owned by the church commissioners. But then we have 16,000 parishes, many of whom own land. We have Church of England schools, and dioceses also own land. And no constituent part can tell another part what to do with their land. So we're trying to develop a more a concerted effort to have a more whole church approach to how we use our land, where it's possible. I mean, a lot of the land isn't developable and, big proportion of it isn't. The Coming Home report provided some undergirding values and principles around what good housing looks like as part of creating healthy, flourishing communities. And as the church, we have been present in communities up and down the land for centuries. We are invested in them. We also have land. And there are millions and millions of people in this country who are in unsuitable or temporary accommodation. And so the report very much said that the church needs to kind of put its money where its mouth is and lead by example. And it was on the back of that report that I was just about to become the Bishop of Chelmsford, and the Archbishop of Canterbury asked if I would take on this role as lead bishop for housing. I think he was keen that whoever took it on would have a voice in the House of Lords as well. So I've been able to build on that work there up to a point. And so I knew nothing about the world of housing. It's been an incredibly steep learning curve. And I'm only one tiny voice. But I think my role is a kind of demonstration of our will to be part of this enormously challenging crisis, frankly, that the country is facing. And again, not straightforward, lots of complexity. It's very slow moving and it's sometimes deeply frustrating. But it's good that we're there. It's good that we have a voice there, and it's good that we're trying to play our part.
Yeah, and I guess that's part of the being the hands and feet, isn't it? Not just being involved in spreading the gospel and doing the spiritual stuff, but actually how do we meet the needs of our community as well?
Yeah, and it is doing the work of the gospel. You know, it's doing the work of the gospel in action. It's impossible, I think, to separate words and action. And in the end, people will judge us and are likely to be influenced more by how they see us behave than what they hear us say. And it's always trying to hold those things together.
And this past weekend, you were speaking about someone else's house in the press. I saw the letter published in The Observer yesterday by yourself and three other bishops speaking against the forced dispossession of the Kiseya family in the West Bank. The Israel-Gaza thing is a tinderbox. And another thing, as we've said very, very often in this interview, it's really hard to have to cover so many bases and to not go into the nuances. But this is obviously an issue that you feel quite strongly about. What was it that made you sit down with three of your colleagues and said, no, you know, we need to speak out on this. We're going to put our names to something here.
I think the reason it's been the four of us is because we have connections with the Diocese of Jerusalem and the province in various ways, and we've each visited over the last year. So we have met with people, we've talked, we've listened, and so that's the reason it was the four of us in particular that, you know, we felt particularly committed to this. Yeah, it's enormously challenging and very, very difficult. I had a very brief visit back in May, I think it was, but I met with an awful lot of groups and individuals. I did a lot of listening, and I came away just feeling that I needed to be a little bit braver in speaking out. It is very, very easy in this conflict to be so worried about saying the wrong thing that you don't say anything at all. and the silence felt wrong, really. So I, you know, yes, the letter has been published, and inevitably, again, it has pulled people to the binaries, either people who are appalled by it or people who are very, very grateful for it. It is absolutely not meant to say that because we are speaking up on behalf of Palestinian Christians and Muslims, that we're not appalled by the actions of brutality on 7th of October and indeed other actions that Hamas have been involved in. Of course we are. You know, all violence, particularly violence in which innocent people get caught up, is wrong. And this does not need to be a zero-sum game. This is about calling for a ceasefire and a solution that brings justice for everybody, which in the end, I think, has to be a two-state solution. I know it's complex. I know far greater minds than mine have been working on this for years. There are no easy solutions. Silence doesn't feel like the right answer either. I don't want to be a controversialist. I'm not looking to stir the pot. But I have to speak into it as well as I can. And for us as Anglicans in the Church of England, an important part of it for me is demonstrating our support for the Diocese of Jerusalem, so for Christians there. And for me, that province is particularly near to my heart because it's the province in which the Diocese of Iran is also based. So I've long had a history with the province. So I just, you know, with others, hope and pray that we move towards a solution that brings justice for everybody and where nobody is free to act above the law.
What was it like visiting this year? I mean, it's... I'm assuming it's not the first time you've ever been to the Holy Land. What was it like visiting it in the midst of everything that's going on, and how is the church coping? What's it like to be a Christian there at the moment?
I have visited several times, but I hadn't been for a long time. And this was obviously very unusual circumstances. It was very, very intense. What was palpable was the sense of trauma which people are living with on every side. You know, absolute shock and disbelief amongst the many Jewish people that an attack like the 7th of October could have even happened. You know, I think they felt they were safe and secure. So trauma on both sides, an inability, for the most part, an inability to make any connection between the two narratives. It felt like they are on parallel paths, that the news outlets that people listen to, the stories they tell one another, are not engaging. With some notable exceptions, there are some brave individuals and groups who are committed to trying to cross those boundaries. And it's very, very moving and inspiring, but it's hard work for them. So, yeah, that's the best. I was only there for about 3 days, but I met with individuals, NGOs, charities, you know, but I think that's how I would best describe it. Trauma, palpable trauma on both sides, and a real struggle for the two narratives to engage well together.
And are Christians actively suffering in the Israeli land confiscation and demolition that's happening in the West Bank at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So obviously the Kassir family that we've mentioned, I mean, there's one example. I managed to visit the church in Ramallah and Bir Zeit in the West Bank while I was there. And amongst others, I met with the family of a young woman called Leanne Nasser, who is under administrative detention. She was arrested, it's about 5 months ago now, 5 or 6 months ago, in the middle of the night. She's a young Palestinian Christian, 24 years old. She was arrested in the middle of the night, taken off and incarcerated. No charges have been brought. Her family have not been allowed to see her or meet with her. I committed during my time there with her family, particularly I spoke at length with her mother, that I pray every day for Leanne. I have a candle lit in my chapel that will remain lit until she's released. I know from my own experience what it's like for a Christian community to feel abandoned and beleaguered. You know, I'm a mother myself. I'm a human being. You know, at a human level we can connect, but I'm a mother myself. I've got children the same sort of age. So, this is affecting Christians as well as Muslims. Palestinians have always been a mix of Christian and Muslim, and they've lived peaceably alongside one another for the most part.
And what is it that you think the international community should be doing?
You know, there's a lot of talk about the fact that what's going on in Gaza is now caused too many innocent lives to be lost. And yet the international community is still providing arms for Israeli state. The International Court of Justice has spoken out on this as well. And yet governments, it seems to me, there is fear of conflating criticism of the Jewish state with criticism of Jewish people and being anti-Semitic. And in the end, we have to find a way of being able to separate those two things out. There is no place for anti-Semitism, but neither should any government be above the law. And the way in which the state currently condone or at least don't act against those who are settlers and who are dispossessing Palestinians of their land, I think we have to stand against it. I know it's really difficult, and I know I'll get criticised for saying this if you put it out there. You know, we expect high standards of the Israeli state and government in the way that I would of any other democracy and civilised nation. So I don't think they should be above these challenges any more than I would expect any other nation to be. And in the end, we have to work towards a two-state solution. It's complex. It's not straightforward. I know that. But I think until Western and international governments start to speak out more in these terms and act in these terms, we may be stuck where we are.
You've obviously come in to serve in the church with such an incredible legacy that I can see written all over it. The beautiful mirroring of the things you've been through that have given you a passion to couple that with the gospel and really do some hard stuff. The fact that you're willing to talk about all these opinions and you're willing to stand up and be counted even when it costs you, I think is an incredible... I will edit all this out. This is just me chatting to you. I think is an incredible mirroring of your faith and your life experience. And I think that's the thing that the church is really blessed to have.
I think as a Church of England, we are quite anxious and fearful at the minute about the future and about our survival and our influence and so on. And it concerns me sometimes that we're mirroring the anxiety and fear that is all around us in society. You know, there are so many uncertainties that we're trying to navigate our way through, and we're struggling to do that well as a society in many instances. And I long for the church to be a place where we can model a different way of being that is less anxious, that is more spacious, that demonstrates that we trust God for the future, that, you know, the future isn't just ours to control. And I believe that we're called to be faithful in the present, to build on what's been in the past, to be faithful in the present, and to discern the kind of next step along the way, the direction of travel as best we can, trusting that God will lead us in the end, of course, to the promised land, but to the next step of the journey, whatever it is. So I'm much more keen to emphasise our faithfulness in the presence rather than be too caught up in what I think the future will be or could be or whatever. Because I think that's in God's hands. And every day we all have to practice the kind of ability to surrender the things that we're worried about and we can't control back into God's hands. We do that, I think, as individual Christians. I hope that we will learn more and more to do it well as a church as well.
Amazing. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.